Hello, this is Fred Velarde. I'd like to welcome you to this edition of WMNR's Fine Arts Forum. I am very pleased this evening to have as my guest Knox Sutterfield, who is the music director of the Kent Singers. And they are located, of course, in the beautiful town of Kent in here in Connecticut. So, Knox, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Fred. Glad to be here.
Tell me, our listeners would be interested. Kent is such a beautiful place. How did you end up there? Tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. I graduated from Yale School of Music and did my degree at the School of Music and the Institute of Sacred Music there in 2014, and I started at Trinity Pauling School as the music director at that boarding school in the fall and was there for 4 years. And during that time, the Kent Singers had an opening, so I started working with them, and then I relocated to Manhattan this past summer. So I still make the commute up on Wednesday nights to work with them.
I see. And you're involved in a couple of different groups in Manhattan as well. There's one, I was reading a little bit about your background. There's one group called Inspire, which I found very intriguing. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Talk about that.
Of course. So Inspire is a choir with a social justice mission. We all volunteer our time. Many of us are amateur musicians who have mostly significant musical training. And we partner with community organizations to help raise awareness for what they do and to help raise money for their projects. Our partners have included Sandy Hook Promise, working to stop gun violence, 350 NYC, which is a climate justice group. We've worked with Sing for Hope, which listeners may have seen the painted pianos around Manhattan
in
the summer.
Oh, yes, yes.
So they're best known for that, but they do lots with bringing music to community
organizations. People have sat down and played them or tried to play them at times because you see them in various locations.
Yeah, they're really fun.
Yeah.
And then this season, we've been focusing on homelessness. So we've partnered with Housing Works and did a concert at their amazing bookstore. And then we have a concert on June 1st at the Bowery Mission.
That's outstanding. That's really cool. And the power of music, people sometimes forget how it can be used to make people aware of things and make people aware of what they're happening in their surroundings. And we lose sight of that sometimes. We think of music as just being on the radio or in a concert hall. So this is a very nice way to get people to aware of what's going on in their community, and also they hear good music at the same time.
Exactly.
So it works out well. That's pretty nice. So when did you come? So you mentioned, when did you come to the Kent Singers?
I started with them in 2016.
16? Yeah. Well, it's not that. They've been around since 73, 74, something like that. They've been around a while.
Yes.
Yeah. And how many people are in the group?
We fluctuate a little bit with the seasons because some people head south for the winter. So we range usually from about 35 to 45. We have a few singers who've joined us for this concert in June. There's the allure of performing with an orchestra and
getting
a major work. So we're up to about 45 to 50 45. Right now.
And now they're mostly local folks, mostly Connecticut people?
Yes, mostly from Connecticut. A few from across the border in New York, but mostly from this area.
Yeah, yeah. How do you have open auditions at times? I mean, if I were a college, I sang in college, let's say, and I thought, I went to a concert. And how could I get your attention if I want to be auditioned?
Sure. We encourage people to visit our website, kentsingers.org. And there's contact information there. And usually we invite someone who's interested to come sit in on a rehearsal and sing with us to get sort of a feel. And then we do what I like to think of as a very non-threatening audition or sort of a hearing with me to just get a sense of their voice and a sense of their musical background and skills.
So it's one-on-one?
Yes.
That would make me more nervous than being in front of a group, I think. But again, if you can sing, then I can't. So it would be intimidating for me. But I suppose someone who can sing, it's a good way to do it.
Yes, I try to keep it very very welcoming and easy. We start with just sort of vocalizing and, you know, not throwing you into the fire to sing an aria or have to sight read something complicated.
Hand him something from, you know, I don't know, Solomon or something, something really powerful. Is there a number, or should they go to the website and that's how they would find out? That's the easiest way to.
Yes, the easiest way would be to go to kentsingers.org and click on our contact link.
And what's the training of most of your? You had mentioned the training of the Inspire group. What's the training of most of the singers? Are they musicians, or do they come from a variety of backgrounds?
It's really all over the map. We have several people who were music majors in college. Some of them have been piano teachers, and down to people who have no formal musical training but have been singing with choirs, you know, back from high school through now they may be in a church choir in the local area. Or many of them have taken a break from singing for a while and may have moved up to this part of Connecticut and are looking to get back into singing.
Now, as music director, are there times when you recognize, like, oh, given the group that I have right now, we should be singing X? I mean, does the group kind of dictate what you're going to select in terms of your concerts and stuff? Or, I mean, how do you do that, I guess, is what I'm asking. How do you select your concerts? And now, you're doing St. John's Passion, which is a major work. But in general, when you do your concerts, how do you select what you do?
Sure. We do three concerts a year. So we do a Christmas program in December. And then in March, I usually pick a theme, but it changes from year to year. And then we do a major work or a few shorter major works in June. So, you know, any good conductor, I think picking repertoire is one of the crucial elements. Yeah, making sure you've picked the right repertoire for your group really sets you up for success or major challenges. I try to balance things that will challenge the group, because I think it's always important to be growing and reaching for a new level of musicianship and musical ability, but then also, of course, things that are more accessible so that we can really focus on just good mechanics of singing and being as expressive and musical as possible, so that it's sort of a balanced diet for us and then also for our audience.
Well, people always ask, because I do a classical music program, people always ask me, who's your favorite composer? And the answer is I really don't have one. It's too hard to choose. If you compare Mozart to Prokofiev, you really can't do that. In terms of your performances, I won't ask you if you have a favorite composer, but is there a favorite era you like? Do you like modern music more, or do you go further? Are you more comfortable with Baroque? Or, I mean, what do you like in general?
I find I'm really drawn sort of to the opposite end. So earlier music, which for me that means mostly Renaissance or Baroque music, and then contemporary things, whether that's 20th century or even sometimes we perform music that's just been composed in the last couple of years. That's, I think, easier repertoire for a group our size. A lot of the big romantic works require massive forces, and especially a massive orchestra, which is not feasible for a small organization.
You're really an a cappella group in general, right? I mean, you don't normally perform with orchestras.
We sing a lot of a cappella music, and then sometimes with piano or organ accompaniment. But it's typically just in June that we're doing something with a big orchestra. Though we did two Christmases ago, we did Conrad Sousa's Carols and Lullabies, which is accompanied by marimba, classical guitar, and harp, which is a fascinating combination. So we do try to hire some instrumentalists sometimes for our other programs too.
Well, let's talk about this. You're tackling a big box, St. John Passion, for your Sunday, June 16 concert. How did that come about? Was that just something that you said, okay, we've got the group, now we're going to perform with some professional singers, a professional orchestra? I mean, how did you get to this point?
The St. John Passion has been sort of a bucket list piece for me since college. And we've done, in the past couple of years, Mozart and Haydn and Schubert. And from a logistics standpoint, the St. John Passion is actually accessible in terms of the orchestration because it's just strings, continuo, flutes, and oboes. You don't have to hire all brass instruments
and all the other.
And so that makes it financially a little bit more feasible. Now, from a musical standpoint, it's an incredible challenge. There's a lot of really complicated writing and demanding singing for the singers, but it's also, because of the way it's constructed with so much recitative and solo work, it's not, 2 hours of choral singing. So it's a manageable amount to take on for us, and then some of the performance gets shared by the soloists.
Right. It's like you had mentioned earlier, it's like an opera in some ways, because of the soloists, and you go back and forth. It was written 1724. Bach didn't have brass, so he wrote it with the idea of probably either no orchestra or a smaller orchestra. It was one of the first things he did, I think, when he got to St. Thomas. I always think about him. He wrote a cantata almost every week.
Right.
So he's sitting there with the vestry saying, I've got Easter covered. I wrote this little thing called, St. Matthew's Passion. I wrote this little thing called St. John's Passion. I mean, he wasn't their first choice. So I always think he must have shocked people with his talent, with his abilities in general. But then to come up with these pieces is amazing.
It really is extraordinary. I mean, the expectation at that time was that these composers who lived in residence, were the Kapellmeisters, that they would compose new music all the time.
Yes.
And it's amazing. I mean, Bach would recycle some of his material, and he set out with, while he was in Leipzig, composing a cycle where he would sort of have a cantata for every Sunday conceivably used down the road. And he did reuse the St. John Passion. There are four versions of it. The fourth version having never actually been performed in his lifetime, but he made some revisions over time. There are a few changes in orchestration. A couple of movements were swapped out here and there. But he did revisit this a few times, but it would have been extraordinary. I mean, you said every Sunday his congregation would have been treated to these incredible cantatas, but they were usually, a couple of movements, maybe 15 to 30 minutes of music.
Right.
And then they would have gone all of Lent with no cantata on Sunday. And then suddenly you get to Holy Week.
You get to Good Friday. Yes.
And then Good Friday, you have this three-hour service, right, that representing the 3 hours that Jesus was on the cross. And so all of a sudden you have Bach writing these passions. And after 40 days of, none of this kind of music, you have this extraordinary, dramatic, and monumental work happening, whether it's the St. John Passion or the St. Matthew Passion. And then there was a Luke Passion and a Mark Passion that we don't have anymore.
One was lost. Was it one or two that were lost?
Two were lost.
Two were lost.
Yeah.
I know. I know. I recall about the revisions in the St. John's, but I always thought there was only one lost. I didn't realize.
There were actually two lost, we believe. And some scholars have tried to reconstruct bits of it. We have bits and pieces of the libretto, and people try to backtrack and figure out, if he was using maybe a movement from this cantata, it's the same rhyme scheme, and try to put it back together.
Yeah.
And so occasionally you'll find a performance. I went to one in Boston a few years ago where they tried to reconstruct the St. Mark Passion. And it's really interesting to hear the sort of speculative work.
Yeah. I mean, I would think when you listen to Messiah, you'll hear a lot of other of Handel's work in there. He took things from other places and said, wait a minute, I'll put words to this. But you can tell. And I didn't realize they tried to do that with Bach. So that's really interesting. Well, talk about these first. We're going to listen to the first three pieces here. Talk a little bit about what we're going to be hearing.
Yeah. So you mentioned, we talked earlier before we started recording about how this is in many ways like an opera. And that really is, the origin of the Baroque period was this interest in opera, and that's the sort of new thing in the Baroque era. And so Bach didn't write operas because he was a sacred composer.
Right.
But opera makes its way in through these dramatic works like a Passion or, you mentioned Handel. All of his oratorios are essentially sacred operas.
Yeah.
And so, you know, from opera, we're familiar with recitative and arias. And so we have those in the Passion. And those are the recitative, you know, is the less, it's more sparsely accompanied and more sort of spoken rhythms. And that carries forward the narrative. So we'll hear a tenor singing what we call the evangelist role, which is essentially the narrator.
Right.
And we'll hear a bass singing the part of Jesus. And we also have, for all of the times that the crowd speaks, whether that's a crowd of soldiers or a crowd of the people or maybe the high priests, you know, all these different roles, that role gets taken by the chorus.
Right.
And
right.
So we use a specific term for that in the Passions. We call it a turba chorus, which literally means crowd in Latin. So they're the crowd chorus that comes in. So the first selection we're going to hear is sort of a scene that we'll hear some of this recitative, and then we'll also hear the choir being part of the crowd. So it's the scene when a group of people has come to apprehend Jesus, and we'll hear them, and we'll hear Jesus say, "I am he," and then, he'll say, "Who are you looking for?" The crowd will say, "Jesus of Nazareth," and it's very dramatic when they come in, and we have this big contrast from the recitative. And then after that, we've got a selection that's an aria, and that's also familiar from opera. So these moments where the action pauses and we have a solo singer reflecting and being, you know, much more expressive and emotional, and the story's not really moving forward, but it's a reflection point.
Yeah.
And then after that, we have a different kind of reflection in the form of a chorale, which would have been very familiar to Bach's congregation. These are chorales that they would have sung in church. Now we think of them as hymns, but they were much more beautifully and complexly harmonized in the Passion. So we get a verse of that, and these are also a reflection point. And the interesting thing here with the arias and the chorales is that we have two different strains of Lutheranism coming together. There's orthodoxy, was an emphasis on the group, right? The congregation being together.
The congregation is important, yes.
And then there's pietism, which is this idea of really personal reflection and personal piety. And so the arias represent that pietism, and the chorales represent that orthodoxy of the congregational reflection.
Amazing. Well, let's listen. This is the first three pieces.
Vermied, wusste den Ort auch, denn Jesus versammelte sich fort, das Herz mit seinen Jüngern. Da nun Judas zu sich hatte genommen die Stadt und der hohen Priester und Pharisäer diene, kommt er dahin mit Fackeln, Lampen und mit Waffen. Als nun Jesus wusste fallen, was ihm begegnen sollte, ging er hinaus und sprach zu ihnen: Jesus, du Führer, sie antworteten: Jesus antwortete, ich hab euch gesagt.
Very nice. That's now is that not the beginning?
No, that's actually we jumped around a little bit there. That was the first scene after an opening chorus, and then not the first aria, but just one of the famous ones, "Ich folge dir gleichfalls." And then that was the first chorale, which happens right after the first scene.
Now, let me remind people, this, you can hear this in its entirety and sung by the Ken Singers Sunday, June 16th at 3 p.m. at St. John's Church in Milford, Connecticut. So it's all very close. And there will be soloists and a period instrument orchestra accompanying the Kent Singers.
Yes, so, which maybe I should say a word about that.
Yes, please.
This recording we're hearing is by the Bach Collegium Japan, and they are a period instrument orchestra as well. So that's our attempt to recreate the exact sounds that Bach would have had in mind when he was writing this music. So the string instruments are not using metal strings, they're using gut strings.
Right.
So there's less tension on them. It's a warmer sound. The flutes are made of wood, not made out of metal. So it's also, again, sort of a warmer, softer sound instead of that piercing sound we think of with a modern flute. And then the oboes are lack all of the metal, the keys that you would expect to see. So it's a very different sound. And to me, it always seems more intimate and organic, I think, because of the material.
I've often wondered, and I did a program in the past, if Bach could come forward in history and hear his music played by the New York, there's one of the pieces that New York Philharmonic plays with Zuckerman, I think, playing the violin. He would say, "What is that? Did I write that?" I mean, right. I don't think they would recognize it. I think they would be totally confused. I mean, I did a program called Mozart in the Mall. Mozart hears his music being played in the mall and says exactly that. Did I write that? But I think that's why I think the beauty of playing it on period instruments is you get the feeling this is what Bach would have heard. This is what the folks in church would have heard.
Yes, so it's a special thing to get to do.
Yeah, very good. So how many pieces altogether will there be?
It's a 17-piece orchestra.
Yeah, something about the size of a chamber, small chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
So these next selections we're going to listen to, it's another scene where we've got some recitative and then some turbo choruses, these crowd choruses interspersed. And I wanted to play this scene in particular because, as I'm sure your listeners know, Bach was such a mathematical composer and so interested in form and structure while also being so incredibly expressive. And the three choruses you're going to hear, if you come hear the work in its entirety, you'll hear the same music of those three choruses repeated again later, but in reverse order.
Ah.
And so there's this part in the middle of the drama, and it's during the trial scene, and you get this mirrored section where the three choruses you hear get repeated with different text backwards. And just to say a couple of things, the first one you hear, the first chorus is the soldiers mocking Jesus. The second one is the crowd saying, Kreuzige, Kreuzige, crucify, crucify. Yes. And in that you'll hear these really gritty suspensions. And if you could draw a line on the page. So imagine you see the sopranos will come in first and then the altos, and then the sopranos move down and then the altos move down. And if you connected these notes, you'd get this sort of cross shape. And Bach does this in a number of his pieces.
Oh.
And he's not the only composer who did it, but we call it the reclining cross. So if your listeners can imagine sort of connecting these notes, you get this cross shape on the page. And it's something we can kind of hear it if you describe it, but it really is a visual thing. So there are all these layers going on. And speaking of those, then in the third chorus you'll hear, it's Wir haben ein Gesetz, we have a law. And in that, the fugue subject gets repeated, it appears 10 times. And so there's speculation that it's a reference to the Ten Commandments.
Ah.
As they say, we have a law. And so there's so much going on. Besides this beautiful and really dramatic music, Bach was doing these incredible things with his composition.
Now, as music director, are you teaching this to your singers, or do they get it? I mean,
I definitely try to teach it.
When do they start saying, "Oh, wait, you know"? I mean, do you don't feed them and get them angry before they do their parts and everything? But I mean, I think it's because in a modern world, you wouldn't think, but this is, you're talking, you know, a long time ago, and this is a, these are people who are passionate. Is it, can you teach that?
I think so. I think it's really important in these passions for the chorus to know who they are at any given moment and to know their motivation. Just like if you were, to go back to opera, right? If you're acting on stage, you need to know your character's motivation. You need to know what's going on in the scene. And so in this, the chorus is participating as a part of the drama, so they have to be aware. And then, you know, some of these little details of these interesting compositional techniques Bach is using, I think it's always worth pointing that out to the chorus and the listeners, because it just helps you appreciate the incredible genius of it that much more.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think makes it that much more exciting to sing as well when you realize what all's going on.
Let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to WMNR's Fine Arts Forum. I'm Fred Velarde, and this is Knox Sutterfield, who is explaining this to us. He is the music director of the Kent Singers, and they are preparing for a June 16th concert, and that's what we're talking about. So if you can, we'll talk more about the dates and times and everything, but let's listen to this section.
Thank you. ging wieder hinein in das Haus und spricht zu Jesus von wannen Blinden. Aber Jesus gab ihm keine Antwort. Da sprach Pilatus zu ihm: Redest du nicht mit mir? Weißt du nicht, dass ich Macht habe, dich zu kreuzigen, und Macht habe, dich zu vergeben? Jesus antwortete: Du hättest keine Macht über mich, wenn sie dir nicht wäre von oben herabgegeben. Darum, der mich hier überantwortet hat, mir hat
now, in the story, where does this take place?
So what we were just listening to is from the trial scene where Jesus has been brought before Pilate. And so that's what we were hearing, was the narrator, and we also heard Jesus and Pilate. And then the chorus, the first one again, was the soldiers, and they're mocking him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews.
Right.
And then the second one we heard, Kreuzige, you know, it was the crowd saying, Crucify. And then the third chorus we heard, Wir haben ein Gesetz, is we have a law, and according to that law he must die because he has made himself out to be God's son. And that, of course, was the, you know, the heresy, was that Jesus had claimed to be God's son.
Who do you say I am, is what he asked.
And, right.
You know, but it's interesting. And I don't know, do we know this? How long it took Bach to write this? Do we know that? I don't want to put you on the spot.
We may know, but I don't.
Okay, I don't know. I don't know either. So someone will tell us. If we can't answer, believe me, we have listeners who know.
Yes,
and
I'm
they
sure.
will tell us at some point. But yes, I often wonder about the kind of, you know, when you read about, Messiah was written like in 27 days or something.
Right.
It was really, once he got going, he started going pretty fast. And I wonder about something as complex as this. It probably and Bach was working, you know, he's a candlelight and working alone.
Right. Bach did work incredibly fast. I mean, we've talked about how he had to turn out music for every Sunday.
Every Sunday, right.
So he was an amazingly quick composer. And to come up with these things that are so detailed, these fugues that works so well mathematically. I mean, if anyone has ever tried to write a fugue, it's incredibly hard because you have to get these intervals to work out together where you can repeat it in all these different iterations and have it work out and actually sound good is incredibly challenging.
And a rumor always has it that Mozart found it very easy. You know, the play and the movie, they play up that whole thing about how easy it was for him. He says at one point, life is hard, music is easy, or something like that. And Salieri looks at this, says there's no corrections on his page. I don't know if that's exactly true, if anyone actually wrote right out of it, you know, without making any changes or anything. I find it, as someone who paints and things, I find that hard to believe that you would do it once and that's it. Yeah, I'm finished.
Yeah, well, paper was expensive. I think you try to work it out at the keyboard before you write it down,
you know,
so you don't have to waste paper and ink.
Work it down in your head. That's pretty interesting. All right, what's the next one? This is a famous, this is a well-known aria from this piece.
Yes, this is perhaps the most famous aria from the St. John Passion, is Es ist vollbracht. And it's an alto aria. It comes right after Jesus has said, it is finished. So we've jumped ahead in the story. We're now at the end of the crucifixion. And we'll hear a countertenor, so a male alto, which, of course, in Bach's time, it would have been an all-male choir. So it would have been boy sopranos and then men singing countertenor and tenor and bass. We have women singing soprano and alto in the chorus, but we do have a countertenor. Daniel Moody is coming up from New York to sing this solo. And you'll also hear a gamba, a viol da gamba, which is a slightly different tone. It's a cousin of the cello, but I think your listeners will be able to hear the slightly different tone.
Right, right. The female voice, is it Mary Magdalene, or is it who? I don't know who it is in the actual.
Well, interestingly enough, all of these arias are not actually meant to be a character in the story. They're meant to be the contemporary, meaning Bach's contemporary, Lutheran believer. It's someone reflecting on how this story impacts them from a place of belief. The only time that there's a female voice as part of the actual drama is just a servant at the before the trial asking Peter, "Aren't you one of his disciples?" And that's the only time
we have a soprano as a part of
the recits. The soprano and alto arias are really just these reflection points. So it's not really ascribed to a character in the story as much as it's meant to make the listener relate to it as an individual.
Yeah. All right, let's listen.
Der Held aus Judas siegt mit Macht. Der Held aus Judas siegt mit Macht. Der Held aus Judas siegt mit Macht. Und steht in Kampf. Und steht in Kampf. Und steht in Kampf. Der Held aus Judas siegt mit Macht. Der Held aus Judas siegt mit Macht.
You know, it's an interesting point you made. I think you should mention that again. In Bach's time, this would have been all male chorus. There wouldn't have been women. Boys would have sang the higher parts and so on. So I think that's kind of I think we forget about that sometimes in terms of how these things are done.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, even the groups like Bach Legium Japan, who we just heard, or Yale School of Cantorum partners with Juilliard 415, often doing these, you know, trying to authentic historical performance, you know, authentic in quotes, because how can you really be authentic? But most of these groups do use female sopranos and altos and maybe some male altos. And part of the justification for not trying to always recreate, you know, with voice sopranos and things is that boys in Bach's time, their voices would have changed later. And so we really don't know what that sound might have been like. So maybe we'd be a little bit closer if we used, like, early high school girls or something.
Yeah.
So there is, you know, like in Manhattan at St. Thomas Fifth Avenue, there's still a choir of men and boys. And they do performances every year, and they do a wonderful St. Matthew Passion. So there are ways that you can still hear with an all-male chorus.
Yeah. I think it's kind of interesting how those kind of things have changed. As we said, most of the composers from the Baroque period, even some of the classical composers, would not recognize their own music because of the changes in the size of the orchestra and certainly the mechanics and everything. Let me remind you one more time. Again, we are listening to the Kent. Talking about a concert by the Kent Singers. Of course, they are based in Kent, Connecticut. They are going to do Johann Sebastian Bach's St. John Passion on Sunday, June 16th, 2009, at 3 p.m. at St. John's. That's an Episcopal church, right?
Yes.
St. John's Episcopal Church in Milford, Connecticut.
New Milford,
Connecticut, and with period instruments, professional soloists. And you can look online at their website for all the information if you need information about getting tickets and so on. And is there an address that's easy to remember?
KentSingers.org.
Can't get much easier than
right.
that. That's really good. That works out well. Well, Kent Knox, I would when you were walking in the door, I was going to call you Kent. It's Knox Sutterfield, music director of the Kent Singers. It has been a pleasure. We are going to leave with the opening of the St. John Passion. Do you want to describe that? Or is it what
sure,
we're going to hear,
and then
we'll go out with
words.
That.
So this It's a really dramatic opening, and it's one of only two choral movements in the piece where the chorus is neither singing a chorale nor being part of the drama, as these turbo choruses we've talked about. So this is sort of the entry point to the drama, and you'll hear this sort of churning string section underneath and this repeated bass line sort of throbbing underneath, and you'll hear these really piercing dissonances in the oboes and flutes, which again, they form this reclining cross shape we talked about. And the text is sort of the introduction, and so the choir sings, "Lord, our ruler, whose fame in all lands is glorious, show me through your passion that you, the true Son of God, through all time, even in the greatest humiliation, have become glorified." So this is sort of the way that Bach wanted the congregation to be reflecting, setting the mindset to then hear the rest of this piece.
That's amazing. All right, one more time, let me just tell you again. It's the Kent Singers, Sunday, June 16th at 3 p.m., St. John's Church, Episcopal Church in New Milford, Connecticut. KentSingers.org
yes.
is the easiest way to find out information. Knox Sutterfield, it has been a pleasure. This is very, very exciting to hear this and hear this music, and it'll be exciting to hear it in person on June 16th. So I wish you the best of luck. And
thank you, Fred.
And hope we'll talk about your upcoming scenes and have you back and talk about your new season that comes up, and we'll do this once more. But we will leave with the beginning of St. John's Passion.
Thank you.